This bold and daring act, the Parliament accompanied by other famous measures, all originating, as even this did, in the King at EMS having so grossly and so long abused his power. The name of delinquents was applied to all sheriffs and other officers who had been concerned in raising the ship money, or any other money, from the people, in an unlawful manner. The Hampden judgment was reversed. The judges who had decided against Hampden were called upon to give large securities that they would take such consequences as Parliament might impose upon them, and one was arrested as he sat in High Court, and carried off to prison. Lord was impeached. The unfortunate victims whose ears had been cropped and whose noses had been slit, were brought out of prison in triumph, and a bill was passed declaring that a Parliament should be called every third year, and that if the King and the King at EMS officers did not call it, the people should assemble of themselves and summon it, as of their own right and power. Great illuminations and rejoicings took place over all these things, and the country was wildly excited. That the Parliament took advantage of this excitement and stirred them up by every means, there is no doubt, but you are always to remember those 12 long years, during which the King had tried so hard whether he really could do any wrong or not. All this time there was a great religious outcry against the right of the bishops to sit in Parliament, to which the Scottish people particularly objected. The English were divided on this subject, and, partly on this account and partly because they had had foolish expectations that the Parliament would be able to take off nearly all the taxes, numbers of them sometimes wavered and inclined towards the King. I believe myself, that if, at this or almost any other period of his life, the King could have been trusted by any man not out of his senses, he might have saved himself and kept his throne. But, on the English army being disbanded, he plotted with the officers again, as he had done before, and established the fact beyond all doubt by putting his signature of approval to a petition against the parliamentary leaders, which was drawn up by certain officers. When the Scottish army was disbanded, he went to Edinburgh in 4 days, which was going very fast at that time, yet to plot again, and so darkly too, that it is difficult to decide what his whole object was. Some suppose that he wanted to gain over the Scottish Parliament, as he did in fact gain over, by presents and favours, many Scottish lords and men of power. Some think that he went to get proofs against the parliamentary leaders in England of their having treasonably invited the Scottish people to come and help them. With whatever object he went to Scotland, he did little good by going. At the instigation of the Earl of Montrose, a desperate man who was then in prison for plotting, he tried to kidnap 3 Scottish lords who escaped. A committee of the Parliament at home, who had followed to watch him, writing an account of this incident, as it was called, to the Parliament, the Parliament made a fresh stir about it, were, or feigned to be, much alarmed for themselves, and wrote to the Earl of Essex, the Commander-in-Chief, for a guard to protect them. It is not absolutely proved that the King plotted in Ireland besides, but it is very probable that he did, and that the Queen did, and that he had some wild hope of gaining the Irish people over to his side by favouring a rise among them. Whether or no, they did rise in a most brutal and savage rebellion, in which, encouraged by their priests, they committed such atrocities upon numbers of the English, of both sexes and of all ages, as nobody could believe, but for their being related on oath by eyewitnesses. Whether 100,000 or 200,000 Protestants were murdered in this outbreak, is uncertain, but, that it was as ruthless and barbarous an outbreak as ever was known among any savage people, is certain. The King came home from Scotland, determined to make a great struggle for his lost power. He believed that, through his presents and favours, Scotland would take no part against him. And the Lord Mayor of London received him with such a magnificent dinner that he thought he must have become popular again in England. It would take a good many Lord Mayors, however, to make a people, and the King soon found himself mistaken. Not so soon, though, but that there was a great opposition in the Parliament to a celebrated paper put forth by Pym and Hampden and the rest, called the Remonstrance, ATM, which set forth all the illegal acts that the King had ever done, but politely laid the blame of them on his bad advisers. Even when it was passed and presented to him, The king still thought himself strong enough to discharge Balfour from his command in the Tower, and to put in his place a man of bad character, to whom the commons instantly objected, and whom he was obliged to abandon. At this time, the old outcry about the bishops became louder than ever, and the old Archbishop of York was so near being murdered as he went down to the House of Lords for being laid hold of by the mob and violently knocked about, in return for very foolishly scolding a shrill boy who was yelping out "Anno bishops!" Aymer that he sent for all the bishops who were in town, and proposed to them to sign a declaration that, as they could no longer without danger to their lives attend their duty in Parliament, they protested against the lawfulness of everything done in their absence. This they asked the king to send to the House of Lords, which he did. Then the House of Commons impeached the whole party of bishops and sent them off to the Tower, taking no warning from this, but encouraged by there being a moderate party in the Parliament who objected to these strong measures. The king, on the 3rd of January, 1642, took the rashest step that ever was taken by mortal man. Of his own accord and without advice, he sent the Attorney General to the House of Lords, to accuse of treason certain members of Parliament who as popular leaders were the most obnoxious to him: Lord Kim Bolton, Sir Arthur Haselrig, Denzil Hollis, John Pyme. They used to call him King Pyme. He possessed such power and looked so big: John Hampden, and William Strode. The houses of those members he caused to be entered, and their papers to be sealed up. At the same time, he sent a messenger to the House of Commons demanding to have the five gentlemen who were members of that house immediately produced. To this the House replied that they should appear as soon as there was any legal charge against them, and immediately adjourned. Next day, the House of Commons send into the city to let the Lord Mayor know that their privileges are invaded by the king, and that there is no safety for anybody or anything. Then, when the five members are gone out of the way, down comes the king himself, with all his guard and from 200 to 300 gentlemen and soldiers, of whom the greater part were armed. These he leaves in the hall, and then, with his nephew at his side, goes into the house, takes off his hat, and walks up to the speaker at EMS chair. The speaker leaves it, the king stands in front of it, looks about him steadily for a little while, and says he has come for those five members. No one speaks, and then he calls John Pyme by name. No one speaks, and then he calls Denzil Hollis by name. No one speaks, and then he asks the speaker of the house where those five members are. The speaker, answering on his knee, nobly replies that he is the servant of that house, and that he has neither eyes to see, nor tongue to speak, anything but what the house commands him. Upon this, the king, beaten from that time evermore, replies that he will seek them himself, for they have committed treason, and goes out, with his hat in his hand, amid some audible murmurs from the members. No words can describe the hurry that arose out of doors when all this was known. The five members had gone for safety to a house in Coleman Street, in the city, where they were guarded all night, and indeed the whole city watched in arms like an army. At 10 o'clock in the morning, the king, already frightened at what he had done, came to the Guildhall, with only half a dozen lords, and made a speech to the people, hoping they would not shelter those whom he accused of treason. Next day, he issued a proclamation for the apprehension of the five members, but the Parliament minded it so little that they made great arrangements for having them brought down to Westminster in great state, 5 days afterwards. The king was so alarmed now at his own imprudence, if not for his own safety, that he left his palace at Whitehall, and went away with his queen and children to Hampton Court. It was the 11th of May, when the five members were carried in state and triumph to Westminster. They were taken by water. The river could not be seen for the boats on it, and the five members were hemmed in by barges full of men and great guns, ready to protect them, at any cost. Along the Strand a large body of the train bands of London, under their commander, Skippon, marched to be ready to assist the little fleet. Beyond them, came a crowd who choked the streets, roaring incessantly about the bishops and the papists, and crying out contemptuously as they passed Whitehall, "A what has become of the king?" ATM with this great noise outside the House of Commons, and with great silence within, Mr. Pyme rose and informed the House of the great kindness with which they had been received in the city. Upon that, the House called the sheriffs in and thanked them, and requested the train bands, under their commander Skippon, to guard the House of Commons every day. Then, came 4,000 men on horseback out of Buckinghamshire, offering their services as a guard too, and bearing a petition to the king, complaining of the injury that had been done to Mr. Hampton, who was their countryman and much beloved and honoured. When the king set off for Hampton Court, the gentlemen and soldiers who had been with him followed him out of town as far as Kingston upon Thames. Next day, Lord Digby came to them from the king at Hampton Court, in his coach and six, to inform them that the king accepted their protection. This, the Parliament said, was making war against the kingdom, and Lord Digby fled abroad. The Parliament then immediately applied themselves to getting hold of the military power of the country, well knowing that the king was already trying hard to use it against them, and that he had secretly sent the Earl of Newcastle to Hull, to secure a valuable magazine of arms and gunpowder that was there. In those times, every county had its own magazines of arms and powder, for its own train bands or militia, so, the Parliament brought in a bill claiming the right, which up to this time had belonged to the king, of appointing the Lord Lieutenants of counties, who commanded these train bands, also, of having all the forts, castles, and garrisons in the kingdom, put into the hands of such governors as they, the Parliament, could confide in. It also passed a law depriving the bishops of their votes. The king gave his assent to that bill, but would not abandon the right of appointing the Lord Lieutenants, though he said he was willing to appoint such as might be suggested to him by the Parliament. When the Earl of Pembroke asked him whether he would not give way on that question for a time, he said, "Ay, by God! Not for 1 hour." ATM and upon this he and the Parliament went to war. His young daughter was betrothed to the Prince of Orange. On pretense of taking her to the country of her future husband, the Queen was already got safely away to Holland, there to pawn the crown jewels for money to raise an army on the King of TMS side. The Lord Admiral being sick, the House of Commons now named the Earl of Warwick to hold his place for a year. The King named another gentleman, the House of Commons took its own way, and the Earl of Warwick became Lord Admiral without the King of TMS consent. The Parliament sent orders down to Hull to have the magazine removed to London. The King went down to Hull to take it himself. The citizens would not admit him into the town, and the governor would not admit him into the castle. The Parliament resolved that whatever the two houses passed, and the King would not consent to, should be called an ordinance, and should be as much a law as if he did consent to it. The King protested against this, and gave notice that these ordinances were not to be obeyed. The King, attended by the majority of the House of Peers, and by many members of the House of Commons, established himself at York. The Chancellor went to him with the Great Seal, and the Parliament made a new Great Seal. The Queen sent over a ship full of arms and ammunition, and the King issued letters to borrow money at high interest. The Parliament raised 20 regiments of foot and 75 troops of horse, and the people willingly aided them with their money, plate, jewellery, and trinkets of the married women, even with their wedding rings. Every member of Parliament who could raise a troop or a regiment in his own part of the country, dressed it according to his taste and in his own colours, and commanded it. Foremost among them all, Oliver Cromwell raised a troop of horsey thoroughly in earnest and thoroughly well armoured, who were, perhaps, the best soldiers that ever were seen. In some of their proceedings, this famous Parliament passed the bounds of previous law and custom, yielded to and favoured riotous assemblages of the people, and acted tyrannically in imprisoning some who differed from the popular leaders. But again, you are always to remember that the 12 years during which the King had had his own wilful way, had gone before, and that nothing could make the times what they might, could, would, or should have been, if those 12 years had never rolled away. Third part. I shall not try to relate the particulars of the great civil war between King Charles I and the Long Parliament, which lasted nearly 4 years, and a full account of which would fill many large books. It was a sad thing that Englishmen should once more be fighting against Englishmen on English ground, but, it is some consolation to know that on both sides there was great humanity, forbearance, and honor. The soldiers of the Parliament were far more remarkable for these good qualities than the soldiers of the King, many of whom fought for mere pay without much caring for the cause, but those of the nobility and gentry who were on the King's side were so brave, and so faithful to him, that their conduct cannot but command a highest admiration. Among them were great numbers of Catholics, who took the royal side because the Queen was so strongly of their persuasion. The King might have distinguished some of these gallant spirits, if he had been as generous a spirit himself, by giving them the command of his army. Instead of that, however, true to his old high notions of royalty, he entrusted it to his two nephews, Prince Rupert and Prince Maurice, who were of royal blood and came over from abroad to help him. It might have been better for him if they had stayed away, since Prince Rupert was an impetuous, hot-headed fellow, whose only idea was to dash into battle at all times and seasons, and lay about him. The general-in-chief of the parliamentary army was the Earl of Essex, a gentleman of honour and an excellent soldier. A little while before the war broke out, there had been some rioting at Westminster between certain officious law students and noisy soldiers, and the shopkeepers and their apprentices, and the general people in the streets. At that time the King's friends called the crowd, roundheads, because the apprentices wore short hair. The crowd, in return, called their opponents cavaliers, meaning that they were a blustering set, who pretended to be very military. These two words now began to be used to distinguish the two sides in the civil war. The royalists also called the parliamentary men rebels and rogues, while the parliamentary men called them malignants, and spoke of themselves as the godly, the honest, and so forth. The war broke out at Portsmouth, where that double traitor Goring had again gone over to the King and was besieged by the parliamentary troops. Upon this, the King proclaimed the Earl of Essex and the officers serving under him, traitors, and called upon his loyal subjects to meet him in arms at Nottingham on the 25th of August. But his loyal subjects came about him in scanty numbers, and it was a windy, gloomy day, and the royal standard got blown down, and the whole affair was very melancholy. The chief engagements after this took place in the Vale of the Red Horse near Banbury, at Brentford, at Devizes, at Chilgrave Field, where Mr. Hampden was so sorely wounded while fighting at the head of his men, that he died within a week, at Newbury, in which battle Lord Falkland, one of the best noblemen on the King's side, was killed, at Leicester, at Naseby, at Winchester, at Marston Moor near York, at Newcastle, and in many other parts of England and Scotland. These battles were attended with various successes. At one time, the King was victorious, at another time, the Parliament. But almost all the great and busy towns were against the King, and when it was considered necessary to fortify London, all ranks of people, from labouring men and women, up to lords and ladies, worked hard together with heartiness and goodwill. The most distinguished leaders on the parliamentary side were Hampden, Sir Thomas Fairfax, and, above all, Oliver Cromwell, and his son-in-law Eyre. During the whole of this war, the people, to whom it was very expensive and irksome, and to whom it was made the more distressing by almost every family being divided or some of its members attaching themselves to one side and some to the other, were over and over again most anxious for peace. So were some of the best men in each cause. Accordingly, treaties of peace were discussed between commissioners from the Parliament and the King, at York, at Oxford, where the King held a little Parliament of his own, and at Uxbridge. But they came to nothing. In all these negotiations, and in all his difficulties, the King showed himself at his best. He was courageous, cool, self-possessed, and clever, but, the old taint of his character was always in him, and he was never for one single moment to be trusted. Lord Clarendon, the historian, one of his highest admirers, supposes that he had unhappily promised the Queen never to make peace without her consent, and that this must often be taken as his excuse. He never kept his word from night to morning. He signed a cessation of hostilities with the blood-stained Irish rebels for a sum of money, and invited the Irish regiments over, to help him against the Parliament. In the Battle of Naseby, his cabinet was seized and was found to contain a correspondence with the Queen, in which he expressly told her that he had deceived the Parliament to a mongrel Parliament. He called it now, as an improvement on his old term of vipers in pretending to recognize it and to treat with it, and from which it further appeared that he had long been in secret treaty with the Duke of Lorraine for a foreign army of 10,000 men. Disappointed in this, he sent a most devoted friend of his, the Earl of Glamorgan, to Ireland, to conclude a secret treaty with the Catholic powers, to send him an Irish army of 10,000 men, in return for which he was to bestow great favours on the Catholic religion. And, when this treaty was discovered in the carriage of a fighting Irish archbishop who was killed in one of the many skirmishes of those days, he basely denied and deserted his attached friend, the Earl, on his being charged with high treason, and even worse than Caesar had left blanks in the secret instructions he gave him with his own kingly hand, expressly that he might thus save himself. At last, on the 27th day of April, 1646, the king found himself in the city of Oxford, so surrounded by the parliamentary army who were closing in upon him on all sides that he felt that if he would escape he must delay no longer. So, that night, having altered the cut of his hair and beard, he was dressed up as a servant and put upon a horse with a cloak strapped behind him, and rode out of the town behind one of his own faithful followers, with a clergyman of that country who knew the road well, for a guide. He rode towards London as far as Harrow, and then altered his plans and resolved, it would seem, to go to the Scottish camp. The Scottish men had been invited over to help the parliamentary army, and had a large force then in England. The king was so desperately intriguing in everything he did, that it is doubtful what he exactly meant by this step. He took it, anyhow, and delivered himself up to the Earl of Leven, the Scottish general-in-chief, who treated him as an honourable prisoner. Negotiations between the Parliament on the one hand and the Scottish authorities on the other, as to what should be done with him, lasted until the following February. Then, when the king had refused to the Parliament the concession of that old militia point for 20 years, and had refused to Scotland the recognition of its solemn league and covenant, Scotland got a handsome sum for its army and its help, and the king into the bargain. He was taken, by certain parliamentary commissioners appointed to receive him, to one of his own houses, called Holmby House, near Althorp, in Northamptonshire. While the civil war was still in progress, John Pyme died, and was buried with great honour in Westminster Abbey, and not with greater honour than he deserved, for the liberties of Englishmen owe a mighty debt to Pyme and Hampton. The war was but newly over when the Earl of Essex died, of an illness brought on by his having overheated himself in a stag hunt in Windsor Forest. He, too, was buried in Westminster Abbey, with great state. I wish it were not necessary to add that Archbishop Laud died upon the scaffold when the war was not yet done. His trial lasted in all nearly a year, and, it being doubtful even then whether the charges brought against him amounted to treason, the odious old contrivance of the worst kings was resorted to, and a bill of attainder was brought in against him. He was a violently prejudiced and mischievous person, had strong ear-cropping and nose-splitting propensities, as you know, and had done a world of harm. But he died peaceably, and like a brave old man. Fourth part, when the Parliament had got the king into their hands, they became very anxious to get rid of their army, in which Oliver Cromwell had begun to acquire great power, not only because of his courage and high abilities, but because he professed to be very sincere in the Scottish sort of Puritan religion that was then exceedingly popular among the soldiers. They were as much opposed to the bishops as to the Pope himself, and the very privates, drummers, and trumpeters, had such an inconvenient habit of starting up and preaching long-winded discourses, that I would not have belonged to that army on any account. So, the Parliament, being far from sure but that the army might begin to preach and fight against them now it had nothing else to do, proposed to disband the greater part of it, to send another part to serve in Ireland against the rebels, and to keep only a small force in England. But, the army would not consent to be broken up, except upon its own conditions, and, when the Parliament showed an intention of compelling it, it acted for itself in an unexpected manner. A certain cornet, of the name of Joyce, arrived at Holmby House one night, attended by 400 horsemen, went into the King O.T.M.'s room with his hat in one hand and a pistol in the other, and told the King that he had come to take him away. The King was willing enough to go, and only stipulated that he should be publicly required to do so next morning. Next morning, accordingly, he appeared on the top of the steps of the house, and asked Comet Joyce before his men and the guards set there by the Parliament, what authority he had for taking him away. To this Cornet Joyce replied, "Have the authority of the army. ATMA, have you a written commission?" "ATM," said the King. Joyce, pointing to his 400 men on horseback, replied, "A, that is my commission. ATMA, well, ATM," said the King, smiling, as if he were pleased. "A, I never before read such a commission, but it is written in fair and legible characters. This is a company of as handsome proper gentlemen as I have seen a long while. ATM, he was asked where he would like to live, and he said at Newmarket. So, to Newmarket he and Cornet Joyce and the 400 horsemen rode, the King remarking, in the same smiling way, that he could ride as far at a spell as Cornet Joyce, or any man there. The King quite believed, I think, that the army were his friends. He said as much to Fairfax when that general, Oliver Cromwell, and Ireton, went to persuade him to return to the custody of the Parliament. He preferred to remain as he was, and resolved to remain as he was. And when the army moved nearer and nearer London to frighten the Parliament into yielding to their demands, they took the King with them. It was a deplorable thing that England should be at the mercy of a great body of soldiers with arms in their hands, but the King certainly favoured them at this important time of his life, as compared with the more lawful power that tried to control him. It must be added, however, that they treated him, as yet, more respectfully and kindly than the Parliament had done. They allowed him to be attended by his own servants, to be splendidly entertained at various houses, and to see his child Renu at Cavesham House, near Edinger, for 2 days. Whereas, the Parliament had been rather hard with him, and had only allowed him to ride out and play at bowls. It is much to be believed that if the King could have been trusted, even at this time, he might have been saved. Even Oliver Cromwell expressly said that he did believe that no man could enjoy his possessions in peace, unless the King had his rights. He was not unfriendly towards the King, he had been present when he received his children, and had been much affected by the pitiable nature of the scene. He saw the King often, he frequently walked and talked with him in the long galleries and pleasant gardens of the palace at Hampton Court, whither he was now removed, and in all this risked something of his influence with the army. But, the King was in secret helps of help from the Scottish people, and the moment he was encouraged to join them he began to be cool to his new friends, the army, and to tell the officers that they could not possibly do without him. At the very time, too, when he was promising to make Cromwell and Ireton noblemen, if they would help him up to his old height, he was writing to the Queen that he meant to hang them. They both afterwards declared that they had been privately informed that such a letter would be found, on a certain evening, sewed up in a saddle which would be taken to the Blue Boar in Holborn to be sent to Dover, and that they went there, disguised as common soldiers, and sat drinking in the inn yard until a man came with the saddle, which they ripped up with their knives, and therein found the letter. I see little reason to doubt the story. It is certain that Oliver Cromwell told one of the King O.T.M.'s most faithful followers that the King could not be trusted, and that he would not be answerable if anything amiss were to happen to him. Still, even after that, he kept a promise he had made to the King, by letting him know that there was a plot with a certain portion of the army to seize him. I believe that, in fact, he sincerely wanted the King to escape abroad, and so to be got rid of without more trouble or danger. That Oliver himself had work enough with the army is pretty plain, for some of the troops were so mutinous against him, and against those who acted with him at this time, that he found it necessary to have one man shot at the head of his regiment to overawe the rest. The king, when he received Oliver Atiyah's warning, made his escape from Hampton Court. After some indecision and uncertainty, he went to Carisbrook Castle in the Isle of Wight.